I was inspired to do it, to do Founding Mothers and now Ladies of Liberty, because of my own mother. She was a member of Congress. But before she was a member of Congress, she was a political wife. She still felt at times that she had a lot more power behind the scenes when not everybody knew what she was up to.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's an honor, as well as a pleasure, to welcome to the Miller Center of Public Affairs one of America's foremost political commentators and news analysts, Cokie Roberts. Cokie Roberts, as many of you know, is the daughter of two members of Congress, Hale Boggs and Lindy Boggs. She's the sister of a former mayor of Princeton, New Jersey, and the brother of one of Washington's most influential attorneys. Cokie Roberts was educated at Wellesley College, where she earned a BA in political science and where she was the 1994 commencement speaker. She serves as a contributing senior news analyst for NPR and is a regular on-air analyst for ABC News and appears regularly on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Cokie Roberts has published four books. In 1998, she published a book of essays, We Are Our Mother's Daughters. In 2000, she and her husband, Stephen Roberts, to whom she's been married since 1966, wrote From This Day Forward. More recently, her writing has focused on important women in early America. In 2004, she published Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation. Today, she will discuss her most recent work, just released in April, Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. I could not help but note that the author, whose full name is Mary Catherine Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs Roberts, but who is known to everyone as Cokie, celebrates the important role played by a woman whose full name was Dorothea Dandridge Payne Todd Madison, but who was known to history as Dolly Madison. Daniel Webster referred to Dolly Madison as the only permanent power in Washington. And of course, the same could be said about Cokie. Please help me welcome Cokie Roberts.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you. Well, what a treat to be with all of you and to talk about these wonderful ladies. I have to say, Holly Shulman is here, and Holly is the world's living expert on Dolly Madison. She has done a wonderful compilation of her letters in a book, The Selected Letters, but she has also done something that is just phenomenal, which is a Dolly Madison digital edition. Through the Miller Center here, and you can go online and subscribe and read every letter that Holly has been able to find written to Dolly Madison or by Dolly Madison in most of her life. So it's just an invaluable site. Would that others had done such work, because getting to these ladies' letters is worth your life. It is so hard to do for the most part. I was inspired to do it, to do Founding Mothers and now Ladies of Liberty, mainly because of my own mother. George mentioned that she was a member of Congress. But before she was a member of Congress, she was a political wife. And my father, Hale Boggs, was elected to Congress in 1940, before I was born. And my mother and her cronies in Washington all through the 40s and 50s when I was growing up, ran everything. You know, they ran their husband's political campaigns, they ran their congressional offices, they ran the political conventions, they ran voter registration drives, and along with the African American women in Washington, they ran all the social service agencies in Washington. So I knew how influential those women were. My mother then did go on to Congress after my father was lost in a plane in 1972. And she's very interesting about the difference of power in front of the scenes and behind the scenes. And though she would argue strenuously that a woman should be in the room when any decision is being made, she still felt at times that she had a lot more power behind the scenes when not everybody knew what she was up to. And she could get a lot of things done sort of surreptitiously. But I did feel, knowing the incredible influence of those women, that the women of the founding era, this crucial period in our history, had to be at least as powerful and influential. And, you know, for somebody who's covered Congress and politics as long as I have, you have to deal with the founding fathers all the time. You know, you'd have to constantly go back and read their debates on things like the right to bear arms or the place of religion in the public square. Recently, why it is that someone who wasn't born in this country can't be president. You know, it's been an issue. So I felt like I knew them very well. And I knew hardly anything about the women. I mean, what you learn, first of all, you tend to learn this period of history in elementary school. And for many of us, that was a very long time ago. But also, you learn very little about them. And so I went back to find out about them, and it was very hard to do, with the exception of a few fine biographies of some of the most prominent women. The work really hasn't been done, and it certainly hasn't been done pulling them all together and seeing how they were relating to each other and how they were relating in society. And I was so glad to be able to do it, because once I was able to get a hold of these letters, it was just a treat. I mean, first, what you're doing is reading other people's mail, you know, and that's interesting. And or their diaries. And the women's letters are of a completely different nature than the men's letters to each other. These men, these founding men, were very self-aware. They knew they were doing something extraordinary. And their letters to each other are filled with the weight of posterity. They knew they'd be published. And they're frankly pompous in many cases. And the women's letters are not like that. The women's letters are lively and interesting and funny. And as we do in conversation that drive you men crazy, you know, the women's letters could start with what Talleyrand was doing wrong and move on to fashion and move on to she's pregnant again and then move back to Talleyrand, you know, and so that you got a much more complete picture of life. And also the men's letters to the women, which many of them destroyed, and fortunately not all of them succeeded, are also more human. They are much more filled with fear and ambition and love and predicaments. I mean, to whom but his wife would the great jurist John Marshall have written when he was riding the circuit in Raleigh, North Carolina at one point, that he got there and discovered that he had no britches? And he said, "I immediately set out to get a pair made. I thought I should be a sans-culotte only one day, but all the tailors were busy. So," he says, "I have the extreme mortification to pass the whole term without that important article of dress I have mentioned." Now, what was he wearing? I mean, I can't look at him anymore. I mean, was the robe covering him? You know, it's a problem. But so these letters are just delightful. And you meet these wonderful, feisty, brave women and get to know them, which is great. But you also get to know the men in much more human terms. You know, we think of these founders as sort of bronze and marble deities. And trust me, their wives didn't think of them that way. It is a much more complete and delightful picture. This book starts, the last book ended with the election of John Adams. It was getting to be too big a book to try to go through the whole founding period. And I ended it with the election of Adams because it was the first contested election under the new Constitution. And the loser accepted the consequences, which is a big deal. I mean, we don't think about it anymore in this country, but that for that to happen was a very big deal. And it's still a big deal around the world. You're seeing it right now in Zimbabwe. There's no acceptance of the results, and might be true in the Democratic nomination as well. But so this starts with Adams as president and goes to Adams. The voters were handy. They literally elected the next generation and told us the period was over. Abigail Adams as first lady reflects something that I have seen pretty much in every White House I've ever known. In Founding Mothers, my earlier book, she's this wonderful character who is so brave and so alone and so valiant and so determined and so patriotic. But as First Lady, she becomes a somewhat more quarrelsome person. And many of you probably have seen the HBO series, you know, so you probably think Laura Linney was Abigail Adams, and she did a great job. I was a pain in the neck to watch it with. I kept saying, wrong, no, it didn't happen that way, you know, all that. But Abigail Adams, as First Lady, developed a mentality that I have seen pretty much in every White House I've known, and I've known the ones since Johnson pretty well. And that is a bunker mentality. We are here on the inside doing the right, the true, the just, and you are on the outside taking shots at us, and why are you doing that? And she had cause. I mean, the opposition was led by their own vice president, Thomas Jefferson, and the press was horrendous. You know, it was, I mean, we are the nambiest, pambiest people on earth compared to them. And she became a great supporter of the Alien and Sedition Acts. And of course, that went a long way to doing in John Adams politically. And he was so used to listening to her political advice that I think that it might have swayed him. And it was damaging advice. The one thing that, of course, finally did in Adams was Alexander Hamilton, who, a member of his own party, who wrote this diatribe against him and essentially succeeded in defeating him. And Abigail Adams was spot on about Alexander Hamilton. I mean, she never trusted him. She thought he was, I mean, she wrote at one point he was Cassius, another time he was Caesar, sort of pick your Roman. And she felt absolutely vindicated in her lack of trust when Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury under Washington, and he had to admit publicly to having had an affair. And he had to do this because he was being blackmailed, and he was accused of being blackmailed for trading illegally in government securities. So he had to go public to say, no, I'm being blackmailed because I had an affair with the wife of the blackmailer. He says, I don't say this without a blush. And Eliza Hamilton serves as the prototype of that political wife we have seen way too much of in recent months, who stands behind her husband, you know, smile on her face, firmly placed, wearing pearls, always wearing pearls, and saves his political career. And she did that. He was brilliant, but he was erratic. He was the illicit progeny of the West Indies. She was a Schuyler and a Van Rensselaer from New York. And the fact that she had married him in the first place had helped him politically tremendously. And then for her to stand by him during this scandal saved him. I must say, I made the joke about the women always wearing pearls recently, and some woman sent me a note saying, pearls behind swine. So Hamilton lives, Hamilton survives politically, you know, takes on Adams, Adams loses. Jefferson comes to Washington, and Jefferson, people have talked about Jefferson having Dolly Madison as his hostess, and she did do some hostessing for him, but what she really did was set up a completely different power base at her house on F Street, where she did all of this fabulous entertaining that was very important, because, you know, we talk about partisanship today. This time was so incredibly and fiercely partisan that people were literally killing each other over politics. I mean, the sitting Vice President of the United States, Aaron Burr, murdered Alexander Hamilton over political words. And these duels were almost all about politics. They weren't about women. Washington was Washington then, too. You know, the current Vice President of the United States has had a problem with a gun, but it hasn't had anything to do with politics, and as far as we know. So to have someone like Dolly Madison and a few others bringing these people together, because they lived in these boarding houses where they just exacerbated each other's partisanship. So to have them bring them together, make them sit down, have a glass of Madeira, and behave, was terribly important in terms of keeping the country civil and keeping it together, because it was so young and fragile that this kind of partisanship and rabid regionalism were very dangerous to the survival of the country. Then Madison runs for president, and by this time, Jefferson had been very popular, both because of his person, and he was the writer of the Declaration of Independence, but also the Louisiana Purchase was wildly popular. By the end of his second term, he wasn't paying that much attention. And Britain and France are at war. The Madison and Jefferson have convinced the Congress to pass an embargo, which everybody hates. The farmers hate it because they can't export. The merchants hate it because they can't import. And the shippers, of course, hate it. And Madison is not necessarily going to get elected president. But Dolly just soldiers on, and she makes sure that he is. And at the end of that campaign, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, right, his opponent, wrote, "I was beaten by Mr. and Mrs. Madison. Had I just run against Mrs. Madison, I might have had a better chance." Similarly, in 1812, when he's really unpopular, because the War of 1812 is unpopular, she just wages this full-scale campaign. And at the end of that race, James G. Blaine writes, "Mrs. Madison saved the administration of her husband. Had it not been for her, DeWitt Clinton would have been elected president in 1812. So I was amazed that the men actually credited her and some of the other political women for their acumen. But, you know, then the invasion of Washington happens. She writes this wonderful letter, which is here, and saves, of course, George Washington's portrait and comes back to the city just a few days later. Helps rebuild the city, helps make sure the capital stays in Washington. Philadelphia was trying, and becomes a national heroine. And when Monroe becomes president, the era of good feeling has set in. So there's all these wonderful political stories in Washington, but there are also women shaping institutions around the nation that are making it a more caring and compassionate nation. Women writers are talking about new ideas, women's rights and abolition. Women educators, and particularly women educators educating girls and free blacks and Native Americans. And women setting up benevolent societies for widows and orphans and the poor, fuel societies, which was hard to do. They couldn't own any property themselves, so they'd have to incorporate, which was a political act. They'd have to go to the state legislature to do that. They always made sure that the treasurer was an unmarried woman, so a husband couldn't seize the assets of the society. But they were around the country making it a better country. And here's where the research gets so much fun. Louisa Catherine Adams, John Quincy Adams' wife, when he was Secretary of State, wrote these wonderful letters home to old John Adams. Abigail was dead, and she wrote these great letters to amuse John from Washington. And the year of the Missouri Compromise, the Congress stayed in session much longer than usual. They usually adjourned in March, and that year they stayed till June. And no one knew what to do. They were running out of food because they didn't expect people there that long, all of that. Finally, they go in June, and she goes to a meeting of the trustees of the orphan asylum, which Dolly Madison had helped establish. And one of the trustees says to her, "We're going to need more space next year." And she says, "Why?" And the answer is, "Congress having left many females in such difficulties as to make it probable they would beg our assistance." Louisa says, "What?" The session had been very long. The fathers of the nation had left 40 cases to be provided for by the public, and our institution was the most likely to be called upon to maintain this illicit progeny. Congress had left 40 pregnant women behind in Washington and went home to their wives. And so she says to John, "I recommended a petition to Congress next session for that great and moral body to establish a foundling institution and should certainly move that the two additional dollars a day which they have given themselves as an increase in pay may be appropriated as a fund toward the support of the institution." Now, it doesn't get any better than that, you know. I mean, you have not read that actually anywhere else, but certainly not in a guy book. Well, Louisa was busy getting John Quincy Adams elected president, and she called it my campaign, my vocation to get him elected president. She knew what she was doing. and she was very much about her business. And the whole election of 1824, which, by the way, started in 1818, so if you think this one's long, was, in the end, waged in Washington. All of the candidates in the end were either in the Congress or in the cabinet. So the city was just abuzz with politics constantly. And in fact, similarly to today, the incumbent, James Monroe, was paid so little attention to that the wife of a newspaper man wrote that there was a joke that a committee be appointed to wait on the president and ask him to have the goodness to resign, inasmuch as gentlemen were in a hurry and did not like to wait. The election goes to the House of Representatives because Jackson doesn't receive a majority of the electoral vote. The hope of Crawford, the third runner-up, was that Jackson and Adams would deadlock and they would turn to him. Henry Clay, who's the fourth in line, fourth number of votes getter, throws his support to Adams in what's come to be called a corrupt bargain because Clay was made Adams Secretary of State. But the day the vote was taken, Adams still didn't have the votes. And the women are in the gallery looking down, watching the arm twisting, writing about it. It's quite wonderful. And the man who was very instrumental in throwing it to Adams was Stephen Van Rensselaer of New York, whose one vote meant that the whole New York delegation went for Adams. And his messmates at his boarding house were furious because they said he was going to go for Crawford. And they said, it's all his wife's fault. He does everything she tells him to do. But I actually think Louisa Catherine Adams had a lot to do with it. Adams was the safe choice of the members of Congress. And they had been entertained at her house for years, and she had had them in and made them feel comfortable with her somewhat difficult husband. And so the next generation was elected. And no matter who was elected, that would have been the case. As with this election, where we have no sitting president or vice president on the ballot for the first time since 1952, in that election, for the first time ever, was no man who had either written the Declaration, fought in the Revolution, or crafted the Constitution. It was a new generation. And Abigail Adams gave a testament to that generation when she left public life. I leave to time the unfolding of a drama. I leave to posterity to reflect upon the times past, and I leave them characters to contemplate. So here are characters to contemplate. Thank you so very much for letting me share them with you, and I'd be delighted to take your questions. Thank you very much.
We have three political spouses on the national stage and still standing, Mrs. McCain, Mrs. Obama, and former President Clinton.
The person I think of is First Dude.
First Dude. Which of the historical figures about whom you have written would you most clearly align with the three spouses who are currently on the 2008 stage?
Well, obviously, Bill Clinton is, you know, a force unto himself, not just, I mean, he is anyway, but we've never had a man in this position before, so let's just put him aside. Of the two women still, I would say Michelle Obama is very much in the tradition of Dolly Madison, Abigail Adams, women who were very aware of what was going on around them and had views about it and wrote about it, Louisa Catherine Adams as well. We know much less about Elizabeth Monroe, who's the only other, Martha Washington was also, you know, Martha Washington really gets a bad rap, probably because of that stupid little cap. But she, she had strong political views. She hated Thomas Jefferson. And but people don't have that sense of her. So the one we know hardly anything about is Elizabeth Monroe, and those are the only first ladies of this period. And that is because James Monroe burned all their mail, probably. So we have very few extant letters of hers. We do know that she did a very brave thing of going to get Madame de Lafayette out of jail during the revolution, which was quite something. But when she was in Washington, the women of Washington couldn't stand her because she wasn't Dolly Madison, and she wouldn't entertain, and she wouldn't go calling, and they thought she was haughty, and she didn't have, and all the time Monroe was married to her, there would be letters saying she still has a little too much of the New York in her. And so I don't have anywhere near as good a sense of her as I do of the others. But I think Michelle Obama is certainly in that mold, but so is Cindy McCain. Cindy McCain tends to more be standing by her husband, offering him support and being with him. Michelle Obama plays more of the surrogate role out around on the campaign trail working for him. But I think if you look through our history, that this is a pattern that repeats.
I was curious, your mother spent several years in Congress, and I was just curious about her experience over time, like how she saw the role of women in Congress change during her tenure.
Well, tremendously. When she went to Congress, there were 16 women in Congress, and you know, it was not enough. It was not a critical mass where you could really get anything much done as women, although they tried. And for years and years, there were about 27 women in the House. And they would get together across party lines and work out an agenda that would be helpful to women, children, and families, and try to get as much of it as possible accomplished. Now, the change, and there were never more than two women in the Senate in her era. There are now 16 women in the Senate, and depending on how you count the delegates, 70-some in the House. It's a critical mass, and they can actually, you know, get something accomplished, and they work hard at doing it, particularly the women in the Senate, which is really the only bastion of bipartisanship left in the Senate, is the women who come together regularly for dinners, partly just to be in a testosterone-free zone, but partly because they really can accomplish things, and they do quite regularly.
I have often wondered about Laura Bush, and I guess the question would be, do you know anything about her role or her thoughts?
Yes, I do, and I'm a big fan of Laura Bush. She is one of the smartest people I know, and a genuine intellectual, which is something I would not say about myself. And yesterday, I thought it was quite wonderful that she stood up, and she was the person holding the press conference about Burma. Because that is a cause that she knows more about than anybody else in the administration. And she finally just took to the lectern and did it herself instead of sort of feeding somebody else the information. And she has been highly influential in terms of literacy. The whole Festival of the Book that happens now at the Library of Congress was entirely her idea. And for a while she was doing wonderful sort of symposia at the White House on American authors. And she had scholars of all different bents come in to talk about the American authors, and they were fascinating to listen to. Unfortunately, the scholars started using them as an opportunity to bash the president instead of talk about the authors, and so she stopped doing them.
Hi, I was wondering about if you could elaborate a little bit on the role of the press and the relationship that these women might have had with the press, if they left any written records of that.
Well, you know, everybody pretty much hated the press with good cause. I mean, Abigail Adams kept talking about scurrility, which is a wonderful word. Spell check hates it. You can see why. I mean, the press was, anybody who could own a printing press was a press, and it was very partisan and often outlandish. I mean, when Madison was running for president the first time, Dolly Madison, actually both times, Dolly Madison was accused of being overly sexed and unsexing her husband. This is in the public press. And crazy old John Randolph, who, you know, just keeps popping up as a nutcake, was threatening to go to the Senate to reveal her indiscretions. And Thomas Jefferson was said to have pimped her and her sisters in exchange for votes in Congress. I mean, this was really nasty, awful stuff. And she managed to sail above it, you know, and with her feathers on her turban. And I mean, I give her so much credit for that, because this was hard. And she managed to either ignore it. Occasionally in her letters, you'll get a little dig. She'll say something, I can't tell you anymore, I'm said to have views. But Callender, James Callender, who was the scandal monger, who initially was on Thomas Jefferson's payroll to attack the Federalists, then turned on Jefferson when Jefferson wouldn't give him a job in his administration. And it is he who, in 1802, first wrote about Sally Hemings, and used the name Sally then. And at that point, Jefferson never responded to the Sally Hemings part of it, but he did insist, while the newspapers around the country were running these stories, that his daughters come to the White House and stay for a period as sort of scandal protectors. He roped them in as his kind of shield against the press at the time. And when Abigail Adams and he had a brief correspondence after Maria Jefferson, his younger daughter, died, where they just went at each other, you know, hammer and tong, it was quite wonderful. She did say to him that she could never forgive him for freeing Callender from jail and from the sedition acts and paying his fine, because Callender had been so vicious to Adams. And she said, and I see this, you know, the serpent bit the hand that fed him, meaning Sally Hemings. So, you know, she got her last word in there. But the press was very, very difficult to deal with, and they all had a hard time with it.
It seems that you used a lot of primary sources for your book, and I'm wondering how you anticipate authors or researchers of the future will, what difficulties they'll encounter, since people are using email now and not regular mail.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I mean, the lack of the written word, although I believe that we're in better shape now than we were in the 70s and 80s, when we were dealing almost entirely on the telephone. Now you do have emails, and my great recommendation, even though it's ecologically unsound, you can recycle the paper or something, print out your family's emails, because that is a record, and you'll have it. You have it, people going off to college, or people in college, people getting married, all of that. And even though they're not beautifully written for the most part, they at least are there as a record, which would be very nice for future generations to have and to see. And emails, as we know, as anybody who's dealt with the DA knows, the emails are forever. So they will at least be there. What we have completely lost, and there's a wonderful exhibit at the Library of Congress right now, Creating the United States, where they are exhibiting Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration with Adams and Franklin's edits. And that, of course, we've completely lost as the first draft, because we do write over it and then it's gone. And that's a shame, because you learn a lot about why certain words were chosen and why other words weren't chosen. And it has a bearing on the meaning. So I'm sorry that that's gone from our lives.
Hi.
Hi.
Of these women, who would have made the best president, and who was the best mother?
Well, you know, some like Abigail Adams was an okay mother. She was a wonderful mother to her daughter. But her sons, well, first of all, John Quincy Adams was really raised by his father, or raised by strangers, because he went abroad as a 10-year-old and traveled with his father thereafter. And when his mother died, he actually, God bless the Massachusetts Historical Society, they have John Quincy Adams' diary online, and it's handwritten, and he kept a diary every day of his life from the time he was 12. He was compulsive, and it's in handwriting, so it's not easy to read, but it is date searchable. So when he learned that his mother had died, he said, "I didn't have her in my life that much." But knowing she existed, was such an important part of my life. Just knowing she was there and as wise as she was. So he admired her. Her younger two sons, you know, ended badly. Although I'll tell you this, this is the only nit I'm going to pick publicly about the Addams series. When Charles Addams died, Laura Linney says on TV, he was no man's enemy. What Abigail Addams actually wrote was, he was no man's enemy except his own. That completely changes the meaning of it, you know. And it's a tenth of a second. I mean, you can do it on TV. And so I think they were trying to make her a little bit more namby-pamby than she was. But so, you know, was that genetics? Was that bad motherhood? I don't know. You know, Dolly Madison's son turned out badly and soaked her dry. Louisa Catherine Addams' two older children were raised by their grandmother and their great aunts at Abigail's insistence, and they didn't turn out well. Her youngest child, who lived, Charles Francis Addams, you know about. He turned out well. She raised him. So, you know, you can sort of go down the list. Elizabeth Monroe's older daughter, everybody hated. And, I mean, really. And, but her younger one seems to have been okay. I mean, so, you know, what's a good mother? I think any one of them could have been president. I mean, they were smart, knowledgeable, brave, feisty women who could have taken on the world. I think they'd be amazed that it's taken this long. I mean, it was out of their ken to even think about it. But I do think that that for it to have taken so long for women to get the vote and then this long for it even to be a conversation about a woman being president, I think is surprising when you get to know these women.
I want to thank the Miller Center for having you on the heels of Dee Dee Roberts, who spoke on why women should rule the world. I think it's a wonderful Mother's Day celebration.
Oh, good. Right.
In a conversation with Sandra Mackey, who spoke here at the end of April on her book on the Middle East, a member of the history faculty asked her if she felt that women had a special insight into political events and cultures, and he remarked on her ability to acquaint the non-specialist with the Middle East. In your experience and based on the work you've done, do you see a special ability that women may have for insight?
I'm not sure it's special, but it's different. First of all, we bring different experiences to the table. And that is certainly what I've seen about women in the legislatures. So that, you know, I was so accused them of Chinese water torture on the men. You know, it's not that the men aren't interested in child care or breast cancer research or family and medical leave and those kinds of things. It's just that it's not at the top of their priority list. So the women are constantly pulling it out from the bottom of the pile and putting it back on top. And so it does come out of a different set of experiences. I do think, and this is a broad overgeneralization, but I do think that we have a longer view of history. And I think it's because we are the carriers of the culture. And, you know, we know that no matter what happens, somebody's going to have a baby and those diapers are going to have to be changed, and then that baby's going to grow up, and then the next generation's going to come, and all of that. And so I think we live less in the moment than men do, but that is such a broad overgeneralization. But that's my personal experience as somebody who's 64 years old. I think that that does allow you to have sort of a sort of more rounded perception of the world.
Cookie, the Miller Center has a very special relationship with Concord University in West Virginia.
Wonderful.
The students at Concord in political science and history classes are required by some of their teachers to watch Miller Center forums.
Poor children.
Once or twice a year, they drive the 4 or 5 hours over the mountain to bring a group of students over to see the forum in person. And our next question comes from one of the Concord University students who's here visiting today.
Well, great. Welcome.
The women that you talk about have an influential role in politics during their time, but that at the point they don't have the right to vote. Did you ever come across anything in any of their letters where they found this disconcerting, that they didn't have an actual legal way of influencing politics?
Right. There were women at the period who were advocating for women's rights, and they're here. I mean, Judith Sargent Murray, a feminist writer of the time, Crazy Fanny Wright, who came over from Scotland and was very much an advocate for women's rights. And then, interestingly, you start to see the beginnings of the people you know as suffragettes at this period. Lucretia Mott went to Philadelphia in 1821 as a Quaker preacher, and the Quakers quite unusually allowed women to preach publicly. And she was an abolitionist, and she went to meetings of abolition societies and was shut out, was either not allowed to participate or not allowed to speak or not allowed to vote because she was a woman. And that led her directly to suffrage. And in fact, she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton at an abolitionist meeting in London. This is after this period of this book. But so in this time frame, the seeds are there of what led to the great women's rights movement later in the century. But the only kind of, I mean, you know about Abigail Adams and Remember the Ladies, and there's a, you know, an ongoing debate about whether she was kidding or not. I don't have for a second think she was kidding, because she not only writes to John about it, she then writes to her friend Mercy Otis Warren complaining that John is not paying any attention to her about it. So now she might have been talking about legal rights as opposed to political rights, but she did say at various times during the Revolution, she would write and say, you know, we women are really the best patriots, because if we succeed, you men are going to be held in high esteem and hold all the honors, and we are suffering all the hardships and making all the sacrifices for the cause, and we won't even be able to vote, so we're better patriots than you are. And John knew not to argue, so it was on her mind. Louisa Adams, in one letter, makes a crack about John keeps telling me under the Constitution that I don't have any rights, and then he expects me to do all this work getting him elected. So there were sort of little cracks about it, but that was the most I heard from these women in their own writings.
I think it was Dave Barry who, the columnist, had the phrase of 16 things that he had found out in his lifetime that were important to remember and to know. And the 16th, I'm sort of reminded of that by your commentary today, is that men are like grapes. They have to be stomped on by women in order to remove all the, and I'll paraphrase this, stuffings out of them before they are of an acceptable vintage. I'd like for you to discuss, if you will, those presidents who did not have to be stomped on, if you can think of any.
Oh, I can't. But you know, it's interesting. Ronald Reagan got into a lot of trouble with the feminists when he said that women are the civilizers of men, but he was right. I mean, women didn't like it because they thought that they were being defined in terms of men. But it is true, and I think most people kind of accept that. I mean, one thing that Dolly Madison did that had the French ambassador just agog was that she was able to stave off a duel between John Randolph again and John Epps, Jefferson's son-in-law. And it was going to be a duel over what they had said on the floor of the House about the Non-Intercourse Act. And the Non-Intercourse Act was unpopular enough, and if somebody got dead over it, it was really going to be unpopular. And she managed to stop the duel, and the French ambassador wrote home and said, you know, it was all the work of Mrs. Madison. I don't know how she did it, but it was awfully important that she got it done. So, you know, that civilizing force was certainly there in Washington. I have to tell you, Washington serves as this wonderful kind of leitmotif through the book, because everybody gets there in, you know, 1800 and says, where are we? You know, Philadelphia was a nice town, and what is this place? You know, we are just mired in mud. It's horrible. And then they get used to it. And they start writing letters saying, you know, it's not so bad. You know, this theater is here, and the circus comes to town, and the races are fun. And the new people arrive and say, where are we? And Louisa Adams asks the new Mexican ambassador, this is after the Monroe Doctrine has brought in all these Latin American, well, Monroe had started recognizing all these Latin American democracies, kind of sort of democracies, and the Mexican ambassador is new in town, and he's having dinner at the Secretary of State's, and of course they're saying to him politely, well, how do you like our city? And he says, well, I guess my grandchildren will like it when it becomes a city. And that's, you know, in the 1820s. So Washington was having a hard time of it.
I wonder if you could comment on what kind of legacy Hillary Clinton is beginning to form. Of course, her career is far from over, whether she becomes president or not. But there seem to be such opposing views to her. You know, people just have kind of these gut reactions to her. And I wonder what sort of the sum will be if her political career were to stop at this moment, for example, or?
Well, you know what, I don't know. I mean, people do have very strong reactions to her, and I don't know how that is gonna end up going down in history. People's attitudes to her have shifted somewhat in the course of this campaign. And some people have ended up liking her a lot more, and some people less. So, you know, we will see. But what I do wonder, and people ask me about a lot, is whether, if she is defeated, that is going to set women back further, or whether the fact that she's made it so this far is going to be helpful to women. And I fear that it will be the former, because that tends to happen, you know, that Geraldine Ferraro was made vice president, you know, to try to get the women's vote. Walter Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro lose 49 states, and the next day everybody wakes up talking about the white male vote. Now, it was not her fault that they lost that election. You know, vice presidents don't matter. The only vice president we can point to at all that has mattered is Lyndon Johnson by carrying Texas. And but I think it did set it back for a while. And I think that might be the same thing this time around. I'm sorry to say.
Cokie, having demonstrated a proven capability to write about women and power, would you consider writing about the pathfinders in the corporate world where women have only entered recently?
No, because I don't know anything about it. I found that it was so much easier for me to write this history as somebody who covers politics, you know, because I understood what was going on. I got it. I just am too ignorant about the corporate world to really be able to do that. And there are some wonderful books being written, by the way, by people who do understand it. I think I'll stick to fields I know. What I'm doing next is children's books of these two books, Founding Mothers and Ladies of Liberty. And then we'll see. I mean, people keep saying, what's your next book? I turned in this book, I know exactly when, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on February the 11th. I know that because it was my husband's 65th birthday. And, at 6:30, 25 people walked in the door for dinner. Fortunately, they were mostly related, and so they didn't expect much. But the, and you will see at the end of this book, because it was so quick, there are some typos which will be fixed in the next edition. So I feel like I have just given birth to triplets, and I am not getting pregnant anytime soon again.
The focus on the writing of history has changed since the time that you were at Wellesley and I was at Columbia, and many of the rest of us in this room were in school, away from the great men to women, both great women and ordinary women. What do you think is going to be the next field that will be seriously explored by academic historians who have been brought up in this more recent era, in this most recent group of history books?
Well, again, I don't. It's not my field. I don't know academic history the way you do. I would take a little bit of exception to the notion that great women have been written about by academic historians. I think what we had was a lot of wonderful books written about the everyday lives of women in the 18th century and then the 19th century. And then we've had all these great men books that have been written mainly by non-professional historians, but they're wonderful books to read, and they have been greatly enhanced by the fact that the Founding Fathers' papers, which have been taking forever to publish and annotate, are finally getting there. It's only been a couple hundred years, and it's really hard for a daily journalist to deal with this. And so I think that we still have a lot to mine among the women of any era, but particularly of this era, and we need to get many more of their papers, first of all, collected, valued, and then digitized the way Holly is doing it.
Obviously, you have a strong political background in the sense of your family members, and it was obviously inspirational to you, but were there any other inspirations that led you to write this?
No, it was the women. It was the women I grew up with and then the women I covered. And the fact that I did, as I said earlier, I felt I knew a lot about the men of the period. But the women who were inspirational in my life, aside from my wonderful mother, were the Sacred Heart nuns. And I would never be able to do anything I do without having been raised by them. I mean, they took girls seriously in the 1950s, which was radical, and raised me very strongly to believe that I could be anything I wanted to be, except a priest, and they were bitter about that. And they've gotten a lot more bitter over the decades. But those would be the people who taught me to even care about history in the first place.
Geraldine Ferraro, as you say, didn't make much difference as vice presidential candidate. Were Barack Obama to become the candidate, as appears perhaps likely now, would Hillary Clinton be a Geraldine Ferraro, or would she make a difference?
I think that it would be very foolish for the Democratic Party to pick Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton as their ticket. They need somebody who's not a senator from a state that's going to go Democratic anyway, which defines both of them. I mean, either one of them needs to pick a white guy from a swing state, preferably a guy who owns a gun. And that's what they need. That's where the problem is. And So I would be very surprised to see that ticket. I don't think it's the ticket that will really work for them.
Many academic historians seem to have perfected the art of making the obvious obscure and the accessible impenetrable. Cokie Roberts, in contrast, has made women in the Revolutionary and Federal periods, many of whom have been hidden from history's view, visible, and brought them to life in a very accessible work of history. Cokie Roberts will be signing copies of her book following the forum, and I would ask people to stay in their places to give her the opportunity to get outside, but we very cleverly located the book and the place where the books will be sold and signed between here and the exit for the building, which gives you every opportunity to exercise your right to buy the book.
Let me just say thank you so much. It's really been very lovely to be with you. To come on this beautiful day indoors was very kind of you, and I really, really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about this.